is The Soldier's Tale at the Ordway, September 29th through October 1st. Tickets available, 651-291-1144. Good morning and welcome to Midday on Minnesota Public Radio. I'm Gary Eichten. Glad you could join us. 6 weeks from today, Minnesotans will be electing a U.S. Senator. Now, if you believe the polls, that new U.S. Senator will either be incumbent Senator Republican Rod Grams or former state auditor and well-known DFLer Mark Dayton. But there are several other candidates in the race as well, including our guest this hour, James Gibson. Mr. Gibson is running on Jesse Ventura's Independence Party ticket, hoping to catch some of the same magic that propelled Ventura to victory just 2 years ago. According to those same polls, James Gibson still has lots of ground to make up in these final 6 weeks of the campaign, but he has been arguing that his moderate positions on the issues offer Minnesotans a genuine choice this fall. Well, today, as part of our Meet the Candidate series, James Gibson has come by to talk about his campaign and his stand on the issues. And we invite you to join our conversation as well. Great way to find out a little bit more about the candidates who you're going to be asked to vote on in just 6 weeks. Give us a call here, 651-227-6000, 651-227-6000. Outside the Twin Cities, you can reach us toll-free, and that number is 1-800-242-2828. 651-227-6000 or 1-800-242-2828. James Gibson, thanks for coming in today.
Good morning, Gary.
Now, you have been actually running for a year and a half. Are you satisfied with where you're standing today, 6 weeks from the election?
I am. I think things have gone as well as could be expected, perhaps better. You know, we didn't have the same kind of high-profile primary that the Democrats had, so I would expect that we would be much lower in the polls at this point than the Democrats. But now we're in the general, and we have the visibility of the general, and we're on a peer relationship with the Democrat, with Senator Grams, and with Mark Dayton. And that visibility will translate into higher name recognition and higher standing in the polls very quickly.
What do you think it's going to take to catch them in the next 6 weeks? What do you see as the key here down the stretch?
Well, the debates are critical. I have to do very well in the debates, and that will certainly be a focus. But I think the message that I have is the right message. It'll resonate with the voters. And we'll make tremendous progress. Now, our biggest challenge is also going to be fundraising. There's no question that we've got to raise some significant dollars in the next few weeks if we're going to run a viable campaign. So if I'm going to be the next senator, the citizens of Minnesota will hopefully support me and help contribute to this campaign, and I think we'll make tremendous progress.
Are you taking money from wherever it comes, or have you put some limits on who you'll accept money from?
Well, we're not accepting political action committee money, so this is all money coming from individuals. We're pushing quite strongly the premise that if a third of the people that contributed to the governor's campaign contribute just $5, we'll have all the money we need.
Mm-hmm. Now, Governor Ventura 2 years ago made a real point of playing to the non-voters, people who normally would sit out these elections because they didn't feel represented by either the Democrats or Republicans or just didn't care. Is that who you're trying to target, or are you going after the people who would normally vote in a general election?
Well, the message is really directed to youth, and certainly a high percentage of youth do not vote. The message that I have of intergenerational justice is specifically targeted to youth. And people my age, I'm 47, and my parents' age would buy into that message out of concern for their children and grandchildren, surely. But the message has particular benefit to the youth, and that's really the target of this campaign.
Mm-hmm. As part of that message, you have emphasized the need to use any surplus money that's available at the federal level to pay off the national debt, or at least pay down the national debt. Is that the wisest use of the money, you think? I suppose an argument could be made to say, well, you might want to reduce a little bit, but over time, as the economy grows and so on, the the size of that debt relative to the economy and relative to the federal budget, for that matter, really shrinks.
Well, certainly it's the ratio, as you point out, the ratio of the debt to the size of overall economy that is the most important. But you can't make a good argument where the national debt is of any benefit to you, and I can make a number of arguments why paying it down has benefit. You have to remember that this debt was incurred over the last, most of it incurred over the last two decades. We had about $1 trillion in debt back in 1980, and now we have almost $6 trillion. And that $5 trillion effectively represents capital that we siphoned off of the private sector markets. That money would have been money that would have been invested in private sector investments, and we borrowed from that. When we pay down the debt, we're effectively returning that, and we're pushing down interest rates. We're returning to the private sector markets, and that allows businesses to make those investments again. And there's a pool of savings to do that from.
Is that a big deal, though? I mean, for the last 8 years, the economy has been booming, with or without the debt.
Part of the reason it's been booming is that we've started to run these surpluses, even as savings rates in from private individuals has been very low. Business savings has generally been pretty strong, and government is now a net saver, and that's helped to keep interest rates down. If you go back into the height of our budget deficits, government was a negative saver to the tune of about negative 5%. It's now a positive saver. So when we look at overall national savings, which is a significant factor in determining the kind of growth an economy can sustain, the overall national savings is composed of private savings, business savings, and government savings. And so to have a strong government savings component is very important at this point, particularly because of the low savings rates from private individuals right now.
Mm-hmm. Republicans will argue that, well, we've tightened our belt, we've got our budget deficits under control, and the people should get some of their money back at this point. The Democrats in general would argue that, well, we've tightened our belt, we've gotten the deficits under control, and it's time now to address some of the unmet needs that have accumulated over recent years.
Well, there is a clear distinction between where I stand and where Senator Graham's and Mark Dayton stands. And that distinction is that I do want to see the surplus used to repay the national debt. Senator Graham wants to return it in the form of a tax cut. Mark Dayton wants to expand federal government. I feel we have much more to gain by paying down this debt, by pushing down those interest rates, by creating the environment where private sector creates the additional investments. We all have a huge stake in economic growth. Ultimately, it determines our capacity to deal with a whole range of social issues. Now, for those, I'm amused by the argument that Senator Graham's and other Republicans will offer that, you know, we deserve a tax cut now, or that we've been overcharged, or are being overcharged. By that logic, we've been undercharged for the last two decades. We've purchased more in government services than we've paid for. And this is unfair from an intergenerational justice standpoint. I think it's simply time to correct that, to reverse that past collective irresponsibility. And I think that will hold us in good stead.
Independence Party Senate candidate James Gibson is our guest this hour, part of our Meet the Candidate series. And we hope to have all the candidates in to talk with them at some length about their campaigns, their stand on the issues, so that hopefully come November, you'll have a better idea of who you might want to vote for. If you'd like to join our conversation here, if you've got a question for James Gibson, give us a call, 651-227-6000. 651-227-6000. Outside the Twin Cities, you can reach us toll-free at 1-800-242-2828. 651-227-6000 or 1-800-242-2828. Just one more question here before we get to our callers. In terms of tax cuts, Governor Bush is talking about a big across-the-board tax cut. Al Gore talking about more targeted tax cuts. Senator Graham's is talking about an across-the-board tax cut. Mark Dayton has talked about some targeted tax cuts. If you had to have some kind of a tax cut, what would you prefer?
Oh, if I had to have some kind.
Well, presumably you're in the Senate now, and there's great momentum in the Senate to pass a tax bill, and it comes time for you to vote, and you'd rather vote no, but you have to make a choice here as to what kind of tax cut might you support.
If we had some change in the tax laws, I would prefer the kinds of changes that simplify the tax code, and there are a number of provisions in the tax code which provide only marginal income for the United States government, but they create and add complexity to the tax code. I prefer that we take a very close look, itemize those things, and see if by willing to give up a very small amount of money, revenue, that we can simplify the way we calculate taxes.
Can you give us an idea of one example of one of those programs?
It goes right down the line. There are an awful lot of deductions, so on, that are means tested. Now, the premise of means testing is reasonable. That is, the premise of progressive income taxes is reasonable, but we would have been far preferable to strictly use the rates themselves to do that rather than to be means testing all of these deductions, because every time we do that, we add complexity to the tax code. There's also we've added a lot of complexity by our provisions relating to it's just getting too complicated. I think I better stop there.
All right.
Talking about at-risk investments and so on.
Uh-oh.
Yeah, let's not lose your audience before we get going here.
Right. Eyes are glazing over. Dave, your question, please.
Hi, Jim. I just want to say that you're running a good campaign, but I am upset at the lack of media coverage you're receiving in, like, the Star Tribune and the Pioneer Press. Every time an article, it's usually about Grams versus Dayton, and then at the end of the article, and by the way, James Gibson's also running for Senate. And it's really disappointing to me, because I think if the voters can hear what you have to say, you'll win this election hands down.
I appreciate that, Dave, but just think how much sweeter the victory will be in the end here. But you're right. The media tends to, I want to be fair with the media too, but there's this premise that the more resources they have, the more money you have to spend, the more viable you are as a campaign. And, we've got a long way to go in the fundraising. So from that standpoint, I can actually sympathize a little bit. But they tend to exacerbate the differences. If the media is willing to give candidates equal exposure, it, to a large degree, reduces the role of money in elections. As long as I can be in all these debates, and it appears that I will be in all of these debates, the big televised debates, et cetera, the role of money is far less significant. I'll get that free media exposure. And we've been pressing very hard. We held a news conference to accentuate the fact that we felt we were not being covered properly by the two major newspapers. And we'll keep hammering that point. But I think it's going to be a moot point. I think we will be covered fairly, and I do expect to get real media exposure here.
There are four other candidates in the race, a Constitution Party candidate, Libertarian, Socialist Workers, and Grassroots Party candidate. Should they get equal coverage, too, and be included in all the debates? What's your thought?
You know, if I had to change the system, I would change in such a way that you had very objective criteria for coverage. I'm running a much stronger campaign than any of the other candidates you mentioned. We don't have the resources of Mark Dayton, and we don't have the resources of the incumbent, Senator Grams, at this point. Doesn't mean we won't have, but we don't at this point. However, we've put in... with money I've contributed and other money, we've effectively put in about $180,000. At some point, you ought to say this is a viable campaign. You know, we've got three paid staff members. We've been out campaigning for a year and a half. We're at a point where this campaign ought to be considered on a peer relationship with the other campaigns and taken seriously. I don't see that with the other campaigns. I don't see any indication that they have any plans or any means of doing that.
Tim, your question, please.
I like your positions, Mr. Gibson, and actually I plan to vote for you in November, and checked out the website and filled out the little form for volunteering. My frustration is that no one ever responds back on those. You don't actually get someone that can, get you pulled into the campaign and make you an active part of that. And that's frustrating for me as someone that wants to get involved in politics. Although, in your defense, you're I've actually had the same experience with about three previous candidates for other elections and other offices. So I don't know if this is really a question more than a comment, but if it was a question, I would say, how, besides actually volunteering, can one get involved with your campaign?
Well, you can certainly do a great deal on your own. Just talking to people about it is very important. But I would suggest, if you see the ball gets dropped, and I would suggest this for anybody out there, campaigns can be very chaotic. It's like constructing a startup business, or you're gearing up for, a $50 million business or something, but you're doing it in a matter of weeks. sometimes, and things get very chaotic. So I would suggest just calling into the office, make sure you actually get a hold of a person and ask them how to get involved. You can reach us at 331-6334, and
what's the area code? 612?
612, yes.
612-331-6334. Okay. John, your question, please.
Mr. Gibson, I'm wondering what your stand is on gay and lesbian issues such as DOMA and hate crimes or gay and lesbian marriage or partnership benefits.
I've taken the position that this ought to be treated as a civil rights issue, and just that blanket statement, and that's how we ought to interpret it. Without going into specifics on all manner of things, I just think that, let me just mention one, gay marriage. To me, gay couples get married all the time. It's just a question here whether society accords them benefits associated with marriage, and I consider from a civil rights standpoint that it's appropriate we do that and treat that just like any other couple. Doesn't mean we necessarily have to call it marriage. If many in our society will be sensitive to that fact, but the real issue is that you allow those unions and just basically, and this is already occurring. We don't kid yourself. I mean, this couples commit to each other, and that's it's a valid thing to do. The gay couples have the same need for family and bonding, etc. So I just contend we need to create the conditions that affirm commitments versus not having those commitments.
Would you prefer that those relationships be officially defined as marriage?
I think I'm comfortable with what Vermont did. They called them a civil unions, and that is, being somewhat sensitive to the other side of this argument that when you refer to people as married, that it's a heterosexual couple and a civil union is a gay couple. I think that is a reasonable compromise at this point.
Independence Party Senate candidate James Gibson is our guest this hour. Our Meet the Candidates series underway here on our midday program. And if you'd like to join our conversation, if you've got a question for Mr. Gibson, give us a call, 651-227-6000 or 1-800-242-2828. President Clinton announced that he is going to be releasing some oil from the Strategic Petroleum Reserve to help with heating oil problems in the Northeast and perhaps affect some reduction in prices as well. You think that was a good idea?
Actually, it might be from just a straight business standpoint. If oil is at $38 per barrel and we know it's not going to stay that high, well, we can sell off some of our oil at that price and buy it back at a lower price later on. I don't think we have, certainly this was set up for strategic reasons so that we're prepared in the event of an emergency, but it would take almost an unimaginable kind of emergency where to me at this point that oil supply is threatened. The oil is available from a number of places around the world, and in the event of that kind of situation, our first move would be to secure the oil fields anyway. So I think it's probably a wise move.
A little longer term, Governor Bush has suggested that one way to deal with this is to encourage domestic production, and among other things has suggested that it's time to open up the Arctic National Reserve to oil drilling. Would you agree?
Well, certainly the higher prices will encourage domestic oil production. Opening up the Arctic oil fields, no, I'm not at that point where I think that necessarily would be a good thing to do. I want to know more about that. I just don't feel fully prepared to respond one way or the other on that issue.
Long term, what, if anything, do you think should be done about the energy problems, quote-unquote, that America faces?
Well, I think at some point we're going to have to be frank about and deal with this concern for global warming, number one, and that's going to affect everything else we do, our use of fossil fuels. We're going to have to recognize that we're contributing to a problem. Whether you agree that global warming is taking place or not, there's no question that we're increasing the concentration of greenhouse gases in the atmosphere. And well, that's a huge gamble to take. So I think long term, our biggest priority is going to be to find alternative energy sources. And it's going to be a very, very difficult problem, probably the toughest environmental issue we'll ever face, because it involves not simply changes we're making here, it involves international cooperation. In other words, a certain amount of CO2 emitted here is the same as CO2 emitted in China. If we simply reduce our CO2 emissions and they increase theirs, we haven't solved any problem. It's going to pit wealthy nation against poor nation. From a poor nation's, a developing nation's perspective, They feel they should be able to use the cheapest energy and allow them to grow and so on, and that we're contributing far more to global warming than they are. Why should they have to hold on to levels where they're currently at? Why can't they emit the same quantities that we do? So it's a huge problem, and I think it's going to involve some kind of combination of conservation, disincentives for the use of fossil fuel, and incentives for the use of alternative energy sources.
Would you support what some people would see as fairly strict, fill in the blank here, harsh, draconian conservation measures to try to wean us from our oil dependency?
I think you have to define your goals, and I think a good first step is to sign on to the Kyoto Protocol that will commit us to reducing CO2 emissions to 7% below 1990 levels. We're currently about 20% above. It's a good first step, but it's not going to be nearly enough, and we're going to have to determine how to go beyond that. What we need is a magic bullet, and the magic bullet is not there. Certainly we can expand the use of wind power and solar power. Some of these are much more expensive. Wind power seems to be much more economical. Solar power still seems to be prohibitively expensive. But what we need is a magic bullet. And by committing to a goal, we'll begin to work for finding some solution. And we just have to hope that we find that solution.
Laurie, your question, please.
Hi, Mr. Gibson. I heard the debate between the independent candidates on the radio weeks ago, and you were talking about Social Security, and you had a very, I think, unique perspective about how Social Security is part of, if we really view it correctly, that it's part of our national debt. And just as you really kind of got to the meat of your things, my toddler twins started talking, and I didn't get to hear the full details. I'm wondering if you could elaborate kind of on your plans for Social Security.
Sure. I appreciate you bringing that up, Lori, because I meant when we're talking about national debt, I wish I had mentioned that as well. It's not just a national debt that's the issue. If it was, it wouldn't be nearly as concerned. It's this unfunded liability that we have in the Social Security system and the other pension programs, federal pension programs. So Social Security, there's about $9 trillion of shortfall there, money that would have been there if we use the same standards that we apply to private business and pension plans. So now if you add the $9 trillion onto the national debt and you add another $5 trillion for the federal pension programs, you're up to about $19,000, $20,000, probably $70,000 an individual. This is a huge liability. So, yes, I think it's just as important as a national debt. What I'd like to see is to see that $9 trillion transferred over to the U.S. government, that it becomes part of our explicit debt. So we literally book it as debt. It's an implicit debt now. Has all of the ramifications of real debt. We simply pretend it doesn't exist. But book it as explicit debt, and then we begin discharging it through normal tax revenues. That frees us up to, that gives us basically what accountants call an actuarially sound system on the Social Security side. We have real assets there. They're bonds, but they're real assets to the extent that we declare them to be liabilities to the U.S. government. Now, at that point, we, for anyone not near retirement, and we pick the age of 55, we set up individual accounts. We actually place a certain amount of value in the form of bonds in each account, reflecting the present-day value of the future benefits you've accrued. So it's a relationship to what you can expect, what you've earned in the way of benefits. And from that point forward, you can control the investments within those accounts within certain standards. I need to qualify that because it's very important that you don't take the kind of risk that potentially have a real high return for you, but if those investments go sour, society ends up picking up the tab. We don't want a repeat of the S&L crisis. So there are going to be certain standards, and those are the details. One possible technique would be to, for example, require half of what is in your account to be invested very conservatively. We get much more sophisticated than that, but the ultimate goal is to assure that you will at least do as well as you would do under the current system.
And if, for some reason, the program didn't work out as you envisioned, what would you still pay out of general revenues an amount so that everybody would get the benefit they'd currently receive?
Well, once you've, again, this thing has to be structured so that that's guaranteed. And I'm not going to sign on anything that doesn't guarantee that kind of return. But it's not hard to do because once you've eliminated this unfunded liability and booked it as real debt to the U.S. government, you now have real assets there. And all we're doing is comparing against a system that for most individuals, particularly young individuals, will produce an extremely low return, possibly around 2%. So to come up with a combination, a portfolio that will yield a 2% return will not be hard to do at all. In fact, if we had half of the investments in essentially no-risk returns, we'd probably achieve that. So this will not be hard to do.
Independence Party U.S. Senate candidate James Gibson is our guest this hour. And if you have a question for Mr. Gibson, give us a call, 651-227-6000. 651-227-6000. Outside the Twin Cities, 1-800-242-2828. And we'll get to more of your questions here in just a couple minutes.
Programming on NPR is supported by Ecolab, dedicated to improving cleaning and sanitation standards for leading hospitality, healthcare, and food processing customers worldwide. On the web at ecolab.com.
The Senate is set to vote on a bill to increase the number of visas for foreign high-tech workers. All the H-1B visas for this year have been used up. Some high-tech workers say Americans could fill those jobs and that the companies import foreign workers only to keep wages down. I'm Juan Williams. To H-1B or not to H-1B? Next Talk of the Nation from NPR News.
Talk of the Nation begins at 1 o'clock here on Minnesota Public Radio. By the way, over the noon hour, right before Talk of the Nation, Pulitzer Prize-winning commentator Paul Gigault will be talking about Social Security and his reaction to ideas of privatizing the system. So we'll get to that over the noon hour. Right now, news headlines. Here's Greta Cunningham. Greta?
Thanks, Gary. Good morning. The U.S. Supreme Court is refusing to hear the government's case for breaking up Microsoft. The justices say the case should first be heard by a federal appeals court. The development is good news for Microsoft. The Justice Department had asked the Supreme Court to bypass that step and hear arguments this winter over whether the software company must be broken up. Last June, Judge Thomas Penfield Jackson ordered the company split in two because of its illegal anti-competitive policies. Microsoft hopes to overturn that ruling. FBI Director Louis Freeh is testifying in front of a Senate hearing today. The panel is looking into the Wenho Lee case. A Clinton administration official says a draft of Freeh's planned testimony indicates he's ready to defend the government's case against the fired Los Alamos nuclear scientists. But he says Freeh will also be willing to admit his agents went too far when they threatened Lee. Wenho Lee was released from 9 months of solitary confinement after pleading guilty to one count of mishandling nuclear secrets. The government dismissed 58 charges. The U.S. Supreme Court will hear whether disabled golfer Casey Martin has a legal right to ride in a golf cart between shots at PGA Tour events. The court said it will hear the tour's argument that a federal anti-bias law does not apply to Martin's case. A federal's appeal court ruled last spring that the Americans with Disabilities Act requires the PGA Tour to waive its requirement that players walk the golf course during tournaments. In regional news, researchers at the Mayo Clinic have discovered a gene mutation that may lead to a treatment to help cure colorectal cancer. Mayo researchers say they've isolated a gene that leads to the development of colorectal cancer when it mutates. Researchers say gene therapy could be used to insert healthy copies of the gene into patients' cells, which would repair the cancer-causing defect. The research will be published in the October issue of Nature Genetics. The forecast for Minnesota today calls for mostly cloudy skies in the north with a chance of showers. It'll be mostly sunny in central and southern Minnesota today. High temperatures ranging from 55 in the northwest to 78 in the southwest. At this hour in Rochester, skies are clear, a temperature of 63. Duluth reports clear skies and 59 degrees. And in the Twin Cities, still some clouds, a temperature of 60 degrees. Gary, that's a check on the latest news.
Thanks, Greta. It's about 26 minutes before 12 o'clock, midday, coming to you on Minnesota Public Radio. And our guest this hour is part of our Meet the Candidates series, the Independence Party's candidate for the U.S. Senate, James Gibson. And if you have a question for Mr. Gibson about his campaign, about his position on the issues, great time to find out more. Give us a call here, 651-227-6000 or 1-800-242-2828. Now, both of our current sitting senators, Rod Grams and Paul Wellstone, serve on the Senate Foreign Relations Committee, and they are sitting in today on a hearing with Secretary of State Madeleine Albright talking about general U.S. foreign policy. In terms of general direction, are you satisfied with what the Clinton administration has done the last 8 years in terms of our role in the world?
Well, I think it's very hard to second guess these things. You know, the certain kinds of issues you can see predictable outcomes, but I think anything to do with foreign relations, there is inherently a degree of unpredictability because you can't predict what foreign nations will do. Certainly, a perfect example of that is Iraq. Who would have believed that Saddam Hussein would have survived all of this and still be in power 9 years later? So generally, I don't want to second guess it. I can tell you a little bit about how I would approach foreign relations issues, particularly where we get involved at a military level, for example. I view it, number one, we've got to start functioning as a part of the world community. We shouldn't use the fact that we're simply the most powerful nation in the world in any kind of bullying manner, that we ought to consider ourselves a member of this world, a member of the world community, and work to find consensus. So where we get involved, I think we need to do it in a coordinated way. This is why I look at our policy toward Cuba, and it's entirely out of sync with the rest of the world. I think it's a perfect indication of how we have, how there's an arrogance about the way we view ourselves in the world, and I think that needs to change.
On the other hand, critics would charge or argue that, you get too deeply involved in consensus building, international bodies, and the rest, and essentially you give up U.S. sovereignty on a lot of these issues, and we need to look out for America first.
Well, as long as you retain the right to act unilaterally, I don't see a problem. But any kind of treaty, any kind of organization, you're participating in the rules and agreeing to abide by a certain set of rules. And so to that extent, I suppose you are giving up sovereignty, or at least the discretion to act any old way you want at any point in time. It's more of a formal process if you want to withdraw from that organization. But as long as you have the right to withdraw from that organization and go your own way, I don't think we've really given up our sovereignty. What we have done is choose to abide by a set of rules. We've agreed to those rules, and we're just abiding by those rules. And I think that's an important thing for us to do.
Do you think we have placed so much emphasis on expanding global trade, expanding our role in the world, economically at least, that we have left our own workers here and our farmers subject to the whims of the marketplace, and they're just getting hammered while people who own the big businesses are making a fortune?
Well, I think that would really be a huge simplification, because I believe that collectively we've all benefited tremendously from international trade. And there's a figure I saw the other day. We talked about world poverty rates have been dropped from 34% to 17% in the last two decades, largely because of globalization. And it is you're not doing the world any favor by refusing to participate or trade. I think I really question the ethics of taking that position. It's sort of like, you've got yours, you've got your wealth created, now let's put up the walls and forget about the rest of the world. No, I don't think that's the way to go. And I think collectively we benefit as a society through international trade. There's no doubt there are displacements, and then at a given moment in time, certain individuals are hurt, certain ones benefit. And that's a challenge for a society. How do you mitigate some of those effects? We need to, for workers that are displaced, you've got to be able to reassimilate them into the economy, get them new jobs, and move them into industries that are expanding. And that's our challenge. But I think we'd be far more productive thing to talk about how do you soften some of these adjustments, but help the adjustments to take place rather than trying to put up the walls and prevent the trade in the first place.
Will, your question, please.
Yes, good morning, Jim.
Well, hi, Will.
I am very much interested in family values and parenting. Would you please tell us what kind of example you set in your personal life?
Well, I was not blessed with children. I have 19 nephews and nieces. We're close to all of them, and they've been certainly been a blessing to us. Celeste and I have been married now for 17 years, and she's been very much involved in this campaign. I'm sure a number of you have seen her around. She's out at the state fair every day working, so we're really enjoying the campaign. But I have a wonderful wife, and very thankful for that.
Do you think candidates' lives should play any role in whether voters, how voters weigh the candidates and what decisions the voters make?
I think, I'm sure the public does that, but I think you need to be very, very forgiving of individuals. Everybody has problems in their lives, personal problems, and you don't want to overdo that accountability, I guess. I don't even want to use the word accountability, because it's great if if a person's life, their personal life, seems to be all perfect and everything's going right and they haven't made any mistakes. But the truth is there are a lot of people that have made mistakes in their lives, and they learn from their mistakes and they're stronger for it. And we don't want to exclude them from public life.
Do you see political leaders as moral leaders?
I think they are. They lead by example. So certainly their conduct as a candidate and a member, if they get elected, of our government, that is important. But I only argue that we need to be reasonable about the kinds of criteria. There was some funny comment I heard from somebody. You know, if you were planning on running for president someday, the best thing to do is make that decision when you're 7 years old and live your life accordingly. But we need to be kind of reasonable about that. People change a lot, and they're not the same at 40 that they are at 30 or 20. And that maturing process sometimes occurs later rather than sooner for others. And it's really a question of who they are when they're running for office, who they're going to be when they're in office.
Would you have voted to convict President Clinton on the impeachment charges?
I would not. And I think, there's no doubt in my mind that he perjured himself, but I think a lot of it was, I just think he's, we talk about equal justice. And how it's important that regardless of where you are, what station you are in your life, that you be appropriate, that you be punished on an equal level. But I can make the argument that he had been punished far beyond what any normal individual would be punished because he was in such a public position. And the most important thing to him, of course, was probably his standing in history. And he'll forever be known as the candidate that was impeached, not convicted, but impeached, or the president that was impeached. And it certainly was a very severe punishment for trying to cover up that kind of indiscretion.
Pat, your question, please.
Yes, hello, Mr. Gibson. I have two questions for you today. My first question revolves around intellectual property law and how it is being applied to our, quote, new, unquote, high-tech economy, particularly the cases surrounding such issues as the Napster debate and the CSS DVD reading program debate. And I'd like to listen to your answer and hold on to my second question.
Why don't you just give us that one and we'll work our way through. Okay, Pat? What's your second one?
Okay, well, my second question is a totally unrelated topic. I've been active in the base Minnesota political system, typically the caucuses, for a number of election cycles now. And I'm seeing the caucus process apparently having less and less effect. It was my understanding when I began caucusing that this was intended to be a primary means for Minnesota citizens to be able to express their views in a way that influenced the political process, namely by selecting a candidate.
Mm-hmm.
Yet, especially in the DFL, but also in some of the other parties, you can see this more happening more often. These decisions they are made by the caucusers are being, if not tossed aside, certainly treated lightly by many candidates who proceed to the primary process. I was wondering what other ways of being politically active and expressing your views in a way that could affect the process there might be that you would recommend.
Okay, well, let's take those in reverse order. If a person has come to the conclusion that the caucus system is essentially ineffective, an ineffective way to participate, what would you suggest to them?
Well, I think you're alluding really to the endorsement process, partly that the ineffectiveness of it sometimes, and it was particularly true on the DFL side this time, and the role of money can really subvert that process. Mark Dayton and Mike Cerisi had much more in the way of resources. It's surprising, though, how well Jerry Janusich did. And you can see the positive effect of the endorsement, but it simply wasn't enough to overcome the huge amounts of money that were being spent by Mike Cerisi and Mark Dayton. So there's a problem there, but the endorsement process does have value. In terms of how could you get involved, I think I might answer this question from an Independence Party standpoint. We're dealing in a much smaller party, and I found it very easy to be involved. I managed the first year, got on the platform committee. Well, anybody can be on the platform committee. Basically, you just have to show up. And those are the people that decide what goes on the platform. And I managed, this was last year that I was on it, and I can point to two out of the top five planks in our platform were ones I proposed. And it was just really a matter, at least in the Independence Party, the party really belongs to those that show up. So I think if you get active, certainly in the Independence Party, you will definitely see yourself influencing the course of events.
We're getting into deep water here, but intellectual property law. I think everybody kind of understands the Napster dispute, whether or not who actually owns the material in the Napster case and whether they had violated some kind of intellectual property laws. Any comments in that area?
I think this is, I'll take a little bit of a larger picture here. This is challenging our understanding of some of these laws, how to apply laws that have been in place for a long time to the new technology. Very difficult, and not just intellectual property, but also competition. Maintaining competition. We have a situation, if you've been following the Microsoft trial, you understand how difficult it is. On the one hand, we all like having, not a whole lot of variety. We want standards. And those standards, because of the nature of the kind of business it is, are also creating this concentration and limiting competition and so on. So we have a challenge from the standpoint of intellectual property, but once we establish that, there's a challenge of how to preserve competition and yet maintain some standards in the kind of tools we're using, the computer technology. These are very difficult issues. I don't have good answers on that question for you, nor on the how you preserve competition. I think the courts are really struggling with that. We can, the initial ruling was that we were breaking up Microsoft. Well, I think all of us have some ambivalence about that.
Mm-hmm. What about taxing sales on the Internet? Do you think that's a good idea?
Well, I think government policy on taxation needs to be as neutral as possible because you affect the kinds of how capital is allocated in the country. You can create real inefficiencies if you don't have a neutral policy. You have a policy right now which is biased towards purchase of goods over the Internet versus Main Street, and that long-term is not good. There's a case to be made for it when an industry is in an embryonic stage, but we're probably beyond that at this point. And this isn't just related to the Internet. We've had this issue with mail order sales as well. So I believe we need to move towards a policy which is neutral from the standpoint of where business gets done. If I purchase at Amazon.com, it ought to be because I get better value there, not because of the tax policy.
Mm-hmm. Back to the phones, and we've got a question from Mark, who's in Eden Prairie. Mark, go ahead, please.
Yes, thank you. Can you hear me all right?
You bet. You're coming through loud and clear.
Great, thanks. Mr. Gibson, I just wanted to catch your views on firearms ownership by lawful citizens. Do you think we have enough laws? Would you vote for more firearms laws?
Mark, I do support the Second Amendment, the right for people to have arms. But I think there's some things we could do which maybe would lessen some problems. The one technology that intrigues me is the owner recognition technology. It's not available yet, but I believe it will be, where specifically the a gun could only be fired by the owner. I think it will solve a lot of problems, and I think both sides of this argument can buy into this real fast. Other issues, I do support trigger locks now, but I don't think they're going to be a major part of them. I don't think they're going to solve a lot. They're not a panacea. We need to be honest about that. They're the equivalent of somebody taking their gun and putting it in a locked case, and they have that option now and don't necessarily do it. But from a child safety standpoint, I think if we provide the trigger locks, they're very convenient. They're just there. They're likelier to get used. And if it's mandatory, we require them on all guns, the price will not be prohibitively expensive, so more likely to be used. I also support the 24-hour waiting period at gun shows. Other than that, I think the key is to provide adequate resources for law enforcement to do their job. And we need to be frank, honest, too, about that we are making progress. Gun crimes are down significantly. Federal prosecutions are up significantly. The very thing we've been talking about is occurring, and we are making progress, and we ought not to form our impression about the need for doing further things based solely upon isolated incidents in the media. I'd much rather you look at the statistics, and if you look at the statistics, they're very impressive. I saw one statistic that about youth homicides. They had dropped from youths arrested for homicides had dropped from 3,000 to 1,300 between 1993 and 1998. That's a very impressive number.
Another element of that debate that we hear a lot about is extending background checks, to gun shows. Would you support that?
Yes. I think what we're really talking about is private sales, the unlicensed dealers. And
right.
Yes, I would support that.
Deb, your question, please.
Hi. Could you talk about where you stand on the issue of abortion rights?
Sure. I consider myself pro-choice. I think it's just, these are one of the decisions I think that are best made by individuals. There's no doubt in my mind that's a very profound decision, and the further along in the pregnancy, the more significant that and profound that decision is. I just contend that the decision is best made by the individual, and for those that are opposed to abortion, I think it's, I applaud your efforts to increase sensitivity to that issue. That only good can come out of that, simply making people aware of what kind of decision this is. But I contend ultimately the individual needs to make that decision, and that if we didn't have that, the negative effects on our society would be very great. We'd create this huge underground economy, a new class of criminal behavior, and we'd displace other kinds of we would displace the ability to enforce other kinds of laws. I just see nothing good coming out of that.
Unfortunately, we're about out of time here, but let me run just a couple of issues past you very quickly and just a quick response. If you had prescription drugs, should the government do something about that issue?
Well, the biggest problem right now is that foreign nations cap the prices for prescription drugs, and the natural response for the drug companies is to compensate by raising prices here. We need to provide a mechanism for the drug companies really to allow them better negotiations, allow them to negotiate from a stronger position. And to me, when we provide a policy of reimportation, or if we provide a specific institute, a specific mandate that requires drug companies not to sell drugs at a higher price here versus foreign country, we've given them a tool, in effect, to negotiate with Canada, for example, and say, well, we can't agree to that price because if we do, we'd have to charge that price in the United States. Therefore, you know, we're going to have to charge more in Canada. Ultimately, we need to find that mechanism that allows those prices to equalize. That's probably our biggest problem with prescription drugs today.
Farm subsidies, my understanding is you're not a big fan of that. Do you just let the farmers fend for themselves?
No, I think we have to understand that the subsidies are part of the problem. They have distorted the market in really negative ways, and since their inception back in the 30s, we now have a situation where they've become capitalized. And so the subsidies, by that I mean they become embedded in asset values, and the ultimate effect is that these subsidies in many cases don't go to where you think they're going. If two out of 3 acres in Minnesota are rented, not owned, and the effect of subsidies in that case is simply the subsidies ultimately flow to the landlord, which is quite often the heir of a previous farmer. The more subsidies, the higher the rent value for the acreage, and the lower the subsidies, the lower the rent value of the acreage. From the standpoint of the tenant farmer, they get absolutely no benefit from these subsidies.
Mm-hmm. And finally, I know Jesse Ventura has a big vote, get out the vote rally in St. Cloud tomorrow. You've got a fundraiser up there. How important do you think the governor is going to be to your campaign? Is that an essential element of your winning this election?
Well, he has a huge following, and he's able to, if we can run a very strong campaign ourselves, which we plan on doing and are doing, and if he also can bring in a certain group of voters that vote for me simply because Jesse says, hey, the governor says, hey, this is the guy, that's a plus, you bet, and we'll use that, certainly.
Thanks for coming in today, and good luck to you.
Thanks, Gary.
Independence Party U.S. Senate candidate James Gibson joining us on this first hour of our midday program, part of our Meet the Candidates series here on Midday.
Online news services love to offer live coverage of one of this month's top stories, the Summer Olympics. The problem is they can't. They've been banned from posting or streaming Olympics news as it happens. I'm David Brancaccio. We'll explore the ban's impact on the net news business and what it could mean for other kinds of news coverage later on Marketplace from PRI.
Marketplace comes your way at 6:30 each evening here on Minnesota Public Radio. 5 minutes now before noon.
And here is the Writer's Almanac for Tuesday. It's the 26th of September, 2000. It's the birthday of Jane Smiley, the novelist, born Los Angeles, 1949. wrote several novels and short stories about families living in the Midwest before she came out with her novel, A Thousand Acres, in 1991, which won her the Pulitzer Prize and the National Book Critics Circle Award, a reworking of the story of King Lear, the story of a father who divides his Midwestern farm among three daughters. It's the birthday of the poet and children's author Ned O'Gorman, New York City, 1929, author of The Night of the Hammer and other collections. George Gershwin was born on this day in Brooklyn, 1898, born Jacob Gershwin. He was 26 years old when he wrote Rhapsody in Blue. It's the birthday of the existential philosopher Martin Heidegger, born in Meßkirch in the Black Forest region of Germany in 1889. It's the birthday of poet and playwright T.S. Eliot, Thomas Stearns Eliot, born in St. Louis, 1888. Studied philosophy at Harvard, settled in London, married unhappily, worked as a bank clerk. In 1917, he brought out Prufrock and Other Observations, suffered a nervous breakdown after that, and then went to work for the publishing house of Faber and Faber. His most famous work was The Wasteland, published in 1922, which began as a poem entitled He Do the Police in Different Voices, and which was extensively edited by Eliot's friend and mentor, Ezra Pound. And it's the birthday of Johnny Appleseed, born John Chapman in Leominster, Massachusetts, 1774. He had a vision of heaven as filled with apple trees and collected apple seeds from cider presses in Pennsylvania and carried them westward. Here are some lines from T.S. Eliot's The Wasteland on his birthday. From the second section, A Game of Chess. Oh, that Shakespearean rag, it's so elegant, so intelligent. What shall I do now? What shall I do? I shall rush out as I am and walk the street with my hair down, so. What shall we do tomorrow? What shall we ever do? The hot water at 10, and if it rains, a closed car at 4, and we shall play a game of chess, pressing lidless eyes and waiting for a knock upon the door. When Lil's husband got demobbed, I said I didn't mince my words. I said to her myself, hurry up, please, it's time. Now Albert's coming back, make yourself a bit smart. You'll want to know what you done with that money he gave you to get yourself some teeth. He did, I was there. You have them all out, Lil, and get a nice set. He said, I swear I can't bear to look at you. And no more can't I said. And think of poor Albert, he's been in the army 4 years, he wants a good time. And if you don't give it him, there's others will, I said. Oh, is there, she said. Something of that, I said. Then I'll know who to thank, she said. Give me a straight look. Hurry up, please, it's time. If you don't like it, you can get on with it, I said. Others can pick and choose if you can't. But if Albert makes off, it won't be for lack of telling. You ought to be ashamed, I said, to look so antique, and her only 31. I can't help it, she said, pulling a long face. It's them pills I took to bring it off, she said. She's had 5 already, nearly died of young George. The chemist said it would be all right, but I've never been the same. You are a proper fool, I said. Well, if Albert won't leave you alone, there it is, I said. What'd you get married for if you don't want children? Hurry up, please, it's time. Well, that Sunday, Albert was home. They had a hot gammon.